Janie Lee Grace. Welcome to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show on UK Health Radio. Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I hope you're well as we move towards the end of the summer. For some people, this is going to be the last kind of weekend, isn't it, really, before everything kicks in. Kids go back to school and all of that stuff. So I hope you're well and you're thriving. And what I thought I'd do actually on the show this week is re-spin part of the interview that I did with Denise Welsh. She's just doing amazing work. And of course, she's so outspoken about the depression that held her back for such a long time. She's also really outspoken about her sobriety and the link, you know, between the two. So I thought I'd give you a chance to hear that interview again. Of course, Denise also wrote the foreword for my book, Happy, Healthy, Sober. So I'm really grateful to her for you know, for those connections. So I really hope you'll enjoy hearing that interview with Denise again. Just before we head into that, a reminder that connection is key. And it doesn't matter if you're sober curious, you know, you're just thinking, oh, shall I change my relationship with alcohol? Answer, yes, do. Or whether you've been sober for months or years, connecting with other people who've quit alcohol is so empowering. You know, I mentioned being in the Zoom room, but if you can actually be, you know, in real life, do the IRL thing, it's so great. So we do have a really special event on Thursday, the 10th of September. I so hope you'll come. It's the Sober Club's 7th birthday. And it's all about well-being, 7 ways to well-being. And our special guest is William Porter. He's going to be chatting about his books, Alcohol Explained, and whatever else he's got going on now. And we're going to make sure that we give you loads of great tips for well-being and obviously quitting alcohol if you're still at that stage. It's going to be a great event. We are going to be raising a glass of naughty alcohol-free. If you're not familiar with Naughty, it is such an amazing premium brand of alcohol-free fizz. No nasties in it, very low sugar. It's really, really high quality. It's super good. So we're going to be raising a glass of Naughty AF to celebrate the Sober Club's 7th birthday. So I really hope you can make it. It's at Hello Love in Bloomsbury. We're raising funds for the Hello Beautiful Foundation. It's just a couple of stops on the underground from Euston Station. Feel free to come on your own. I promise we'll make you feel welcome. It's small. It's a lovely informal vibe. It's 6 to 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 10th of September. And if you look at the show notes, you'll find the link for tickets, or you can go to thesoberclub.com/events and you'll find the tickets there. I know it's a school night. I know it's a trek into London, but honestly, you will love it if you come. I promise you. I've got lovely goodie bags as well. So, you know, it's worth it just for that, right? So try and come if you can. Thursday, 10th of September, 7 Ways to Wellbeing with special guest William Porter at Hello Love in London.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
So, so thrilled to speak with you, Denise. I don't think you need a lot of introduction. You're
So well known as an actor and TV personality, and Loose Women, of course. And it was lovely to chat to you on Steve Wright in the afternoon. Yes. And I know you've been doing just so much publicity, which is just fantastic. And this book, as we were just saying off air, just helping just so many people, because you're bringing out into the open a topic that even today, really, we just don't talk about enough, do we? I mean, 10 years ago, we probably wouldn't have spoken about it at all. But even now, it's not that much.
I know, it's unbelievable, because people do speak out about it, you know, and if you Google books on this subject, there are many. But I think that for a lot of people, there's certain people that have their voice. So, for example, Stephen Fry and Ruby Wax have been forerunners in this field. But the thing about them is they've done wonderful documentaries and brilliant, brilliant books. But my audience, Betty from Bolton, wouldn't necessarily relate to Oxbridge-educated Ruby and Stephen. You know, I'm more of a sort of a woman of the people because of the type of shows that I do, like Loose Women, where we all bare our souls. And I've been doing that show for 18 years, and I've shared my life, the good, the bad, and the ugly on there. So people feel they know me, whether they like me or not, they know me. And I started with this illness, which is clinical depression. You said, you know, 10 years ago, I got poorly, firstly, 31 years ago. Mine started when I gave birth to my first son, Matthew. And before that, I had had no psychiatric illness, mental illness, nothing. If I said I was depressed, it meant in the way that we, you know, a lot of people say that.
Feeling blue,
It's only out of ignorance, but it's not, you know, you can't expect people to understand what clinical depression feels unless they add it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it completely blindsided me when I was this excited, healthy, blooming woman in pregnancy. You know, you hear about these women who bloom in pregnancy, and that was me. My hair was great. My skin was great. I had energy. I loved every minute of my pregnancy. I was in a happy marriage at the time. So basically, I was blindsided by getting severe postnatal depression to the point that I was hospitalized. And if I hadn't had the family that I do, including my dear old dad who's just trying to get through there, if I hadn't had my mum and dad and the family that I do, I don't honestly know where or if I would be here, Janie, to be honest. It was so, that may sound dramatic, but it is the truth. Because one of the things that I try to get over is that I think the reason that my book is selling well and the reason that I am getting these amazing messages, really life-changing messages from people, is because, possibly because I've spoken out about the illness for so long, I have a way apparently of explaining it as it is. And even to those people who don't understand it, apparently if they listen to me, they get a better understanding. And maybe it's because I'm an actress, I don't know what it is, or just that I've talked about it for a long time. Because 30 years ago, I would have given anything to have my book. I feel I've written a book that I needed. And that's what spurred me on with it, really. And there was nobody around. There was nobody on the television talking about mental health. There was nothing, you know, at that time, print media was really our main source of material for anything like that.
Yeah.
And there would be, in a magazine, all of the magazines were the typical, wonderful, happy mother with the smiling baby. And of course, you felt incredibly inadequate if you weren't like that. And yet there would be a tiny little piece at the bottom of page 94, which said that if you feel the baby blooms are lasting rather a long time, go and see your GP. My GP, when I was catatonic in her waiting in her surgery with my mum, said, well, I had 5 children, dear, and I just didn't have time to get depressed, is what she said to me. And unfortunately, that she was not alone in that that way of thinking.
Well, it's ignorance, isn't it?
It's ignorance. And my grannies, funnily enough, my granny's generation with the least understanding. And I've done a lot of, obviously, I've talked to thousands of people over the last 30 years, and men and women. But if you spoke about postnatal depression, which hadn't long actually been given a name, nor had premenstrual syndrome, I spent a lot of time with a doctor called Katarina Dalton, who actually had given these things a name. And so my granny's generation, it would be, well, we just had to get on with it. Yeah. We just had to pull up our bootstraps. But then you'd say, Granny, what happened to my Auntie Vera? And she'd say, she went a bit funny after the birth.
Yeah.
And that's what happened.
Yeah.
Our, that generation, they were institutionalized.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
For probably undiagnosed postnatal depression, menopausal symptoms, which can create the same hormonal imbalance, you know, so it, of course it existed, but they, people didn't like to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book's called, I mean, I love the title, because just in the title, it's so funny, doesn't it really? The Unwelcome Visitor, Depression and How I Survive It. And we'll talk in a moment about a little bit more about how it came about by you sharing your story. But I'm just really interested, and I hope this question doesn't sound too ignorant, but it's better that I ask it.
Yeah,
but,
of course.
But so are you saying then that because of the postnatal depression, there was... you know, actual changes, neurological changes to the brain that meant that you then, for there on after, had bouts of clinical depression. So it's not linked in your case to circumstances and stuff that's going on in your life. It's a neurological imbalance.
So my depression started as postnatal depression, as do many women's depression episodes. I would also like to say, to anybody pregnant or thinking about being pregnant or just having had a baby, most women who suffer postnatal depression will make a full recovery. It is completely possible to have postnatal depression and it never darken your doors again. So I never want to worry women about that. I just want to say, but if it does happen, there is now help that there wasn't when I was growing.
Yeah,
we have Kugel for a start. There is always a support group, a community that will help you through until you can access professional help. Because obviously the mental health waiting lists are, it's a tsunami at the minute. Yeah. But anyway, so, but other people's depression starts for completely different reasons, but the end result is the same. Clinical depression is clinical depression. The brain, there's a chemical chaos originated by hormones with me, but it took me 20 years to have someone say, the origin of your depression was hormonal, and you are so lacking in estrogen, said Professor Studd, I don't know how you've survived. Nice. Prior to that, nobody would. And it's like, well, hang on a minute. I have given birth to a human being which has formed in my body and come out of my fufu. And you're telling me that there couldn't possibly be some chemical hormonal chaos that comes on.
Yeah.
So this is what the medics say, even though, and I have great respect for many, many people I've learned from over the years, but a lot of people didn't have a clue. That there is a hormonal chaos when you have a baby, of course, which will result in 80% of women in the baby blues, where you have a few days of complete irrationality, emotions, you feel it's overwhelming, you know, understandable. And then gradually the hormones balance. Of course, your life will never be the same, but in a wonderful way. But with some people, the drop in estrogen after childbirth, particularly apparently those who have a wonderful pregnancy like I did, an incredibly almost euphoric pregnancy, which of course at the time I thought was wonderful. Now that may be a slight red flag for people. Plus when I had the baby and I took him home after a long arduous labor, but I don't think it was anything to do with the birth. My mum did for a time, but I don't, it was long and hard. And they should have intervened a bit before. But anyway, never mind. So I had him and then took him home on the Wednesday from the Saturday. On the Friday, it all started. So I had a panic attack for no reason because I wasn't an anxious mum. The hospital said to me I was the only mum that didn't pull the worry cord at night, you know, going, oh, I wasn't. I was aware I didn't think he was getting enough milk. But I wasn't anxious. I just felt odd.
Yeah.
I felt like everything was happening around me. And then out of the blue, I had a panic attack. And it was the first one, Jamie, that I'd ever had. And
it's been really frightening.
It was so terrifying. And it was like when you are you think you're going to crash in your car. And you think you're going to crash and your heart is like this. But you pull over to the side, realize the danger's gone, breathe, and you're okay. It was like the point of impact never going away. And when I woke up in the morning after maybe, well, a couple of hours sleep, the whole lactation process had gone. So I had gone from having full boobs, you know what a woman's like when her milk comes in, full boobs to nothing, spaniel's ears, overnight. And now that would be a massive red flag. Mm. The midwife came around, who I didn't know, and said to me, very unusual, which you don't want to hear when you've just had a baby. Very unusual. Normally this only happens if a spouse or a baby dies. So I suggest you just go out and get some bottles, but very disappointing. That's what I've heard.
Wow.
Anyway, thank God I had my mum. But the point being is that my raison d'etre, if you were, is to try and find a parity between the way we treat and talk about physical health the same as mental health.
Yeah.
And also to try and describe the difference between what normal people would say, why are you more depressed than me? So an example I give in the book is this. Years ago, 15 years ago on Loose Women, we had a panelist that came on sometime, the actress Terry Dwyer. And her dad was terminally ill and was dying. And she was devastated. And so she said to me, so what makes your depression? I asked her to ask it like this. She said, why then is your depression worse than my depression? And I said, no, it's not worse. I said, but if you went home tonight and your mum said, the hospital have said they found a cure for dad and he's going to recover, would your depression go? And she said, well, of course it would. I said, well, mine wouldn't. Depression depresses every single thing. So there's another thing that they say all the time, which is persistent sadness. I can't tell you, Janie, how unpersistent sadness it is. I have had many, many, many bouts of sadness, as we all have during the lockdown. Mm. This insecure world we're living in, unparalleled. You know, I've had feelings of overwhelming sadness about what we're bringing our kids into. And that sadness, when my mum died 8 years ago, I was sad. I was bereft. I was grief-stricken, but I didn't get my depression. And when you are depressed, you can't feel love. You can't feel sadness, you can't feel happiness, anger, rage, frustration, nothing. You are dead inside. And therefore, that's why people take their own lives, because they can't stand the pain of deadness.
Yeah.
You know, and most people who take their own lives don't want to die, they want to stop the pain, which of course I know we'll talk about, because that led on me self-medicating.
Totally. I mean, you're right. You do have a really good way of explaining it. And it is so difficult to understand for people who haven't experienced it, but so important that we know. I mean, my mum had mental illness, so I lived with it as a child, but I didn't understand it.
No, of course.
And even now as an adult, I sometimes think back and I think, why didn't my mum know that she was ill? Well, I mean, of course she did, but the I suppose it's this, as you say, this ridiculous definition between a physical illness and a mental illness. But
I always say as well, I know, and I always say the thing is, when I am poorly, there's also a physical manifestation of serious mental illness, of depression, and which used to be called melancholia, of course, historically, and the thought of suffering from it then is just, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
That once my depression was so bad that it was so thick, my hands started to lock as though in a sort of rheumatoid arthritis, I would imagine, and my face twisted to the side. And my mum got the doctor out to me at midnight, in the days that doctors came out at midnight.
Yeah.
And he said to my mum, this is the worst physical manifestation of depression I've seen for many a year. We're going to have to take her in for ECT, which we call electric shock treatment.
Yeah, yeah.
And they didn't because I started to come round. But the fact is, I wasn't scared of going for that. I was desperate to go for that. I was desperate to go for anything that would make me better.
Yeah.
You know, they told me at one point that I might have temporal lobe epilepsy because of the way I described the whoosh that can come on me within 30 seconds. And this doctor said, oh, you seem to describe to me temporal lobe epilepsy. He said, but if you have this, you know, and you won't be able to drive, you lose your license. I didn't give a...
Yeah.
All I wanted was, let it be temporal lobe epilepsy.
Feel better.
Not that obviously that's a terrible condition, but it was like, I wanted someone to say, we've been misdiagnosing you. You've got that. And this is the pill to make that better. That's what I wanted.
How common is this then, Denise? How many people have, you know, I don't think I know numbers, but is it really as bad?
Very, my goodness. Very common. It's so common. But the thing about it is that not only do those of us who have it have a crippling, debilitating, isolating, potentially terminal illness, we have to still prove that we have it.
Yeah.
An example being, nobody listening to this show would think of going up to a person in a bed who has, dare I say it, cancer, something really serious, and say to them, well, you look fine to me.
Yeah, yourself together.
Had this for a month now. Do you know what I would do is I'd get up, put your trainers on, get yourself out for a bloody good run and you'll feel better. Nobody would say that. And yet you can't see that person's cancer. My mom lived with cancer for 20 years. Brilliantly. You couldn't tell she had it, but we still accept that she had it and accept how terribly ill that is.
Yeah.
And that's why we read the tragic headlines, because we still have to prove. And of course, that's why so many people self-medicate
and
take drugs and self-harm, because they're trying to get the pain away from their head. And the ultimate is sadly suicide.
Absolutely. Tell us about the link for you with alcohol then, because obviously a lot of people I work with, hugely appreciative of the book that you've written, because they too were drinking, you know, for years to numb the pain. And I'm guessing that's exactly what happened for you. So what happened for you? How long were you drinking for? And did there come a point when you realized that the drinking and the mental health issues were linked in some way?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I was always, before Matty was born, I was a social drinker. I was a bit of a party girl, you know. My mum and dad were kind of social animals. They had me and my sister Debbie when they were very young. They were like 22 when they had me. So rather than leave me, they had their friends around the flat. So they had, of course, in my child's eye view, a normal-sized flat. I've been back to it. It's about this big, but you know. My memories are of this party-filled flat and apparently me walking downstairs with a pin between my fingers at 9 years old going, can we go to the Rex, which was this hotel down in Dymo. So I was always surrounded by, you know, party people. So I loved to drink and I would, you know, get pissed with me mates sometimes. But only in I drank in the same way that everybody else did. There was certainly no element of a problem with it. I didn't need alcohol. It was something I did to make a night more fun. Fast forward to having Matthew. Now, initially, I couldn't drink. I couldn't eat. I lost 2 stone in 3 weeks. My mum had to feed me and try to keep me fed with Complan and stuff. So anything like that was out of the picture. And really, I would say that my drinking became a problem probably when Matty was about 7. And then I started doing Coronation Street. And so bearing in mind, my illness was sometimes there and sometimes not. The episodes would come. Trouble is with mine is they come endogenously most of the time. So I have no control over when they come. And that's the frightening thing.
Absolutely no warning, nothing, no lead up to it.
And I think one of the things that's really, Janie, resonating with people in my book is people who say, oh, my God, for years people have said to me, well, what do you think's bringing it on?
Yeah, you must have known. Something. It must have been something you ate.
Properly. Yeah, you're not eating properly. You're doing this. And I've said, it's an illness. And sometimes there's no reason. When my mum died, I didn't get depression. Last year, the videos we'll talk about that spawned this was me driving up to the Northeast in a fun-filled car to see my sister and her foster kids and the unwelcome visitor came. But the drinking, I was doing Coronation Street and it was at the time when 24 million people watched each episode, pretty much, you know, a third of the country, maybe more. I was used to a little bit of recognition because I'd done like Spender and Soldier and things like that. But Coronation Street was kind of mind blowing. And I was in my late 30s then. And I was terribly homesick because my husband and Matthew lived in the Northeast. The work schedule was mammoth. And my illness was quite prevalent, which I was, I was talking the talk, but not walking the walk. So I was telling people that you should speak out openly about this, but not doing it myself. Mm. Because a soap opera or a long-running drama is a machine.
Yeah,
and it needs every single component. And if you are a lead part of that and you go, the whole thing can collapse. Mm. Also, I thought, hindsight, I would have said I'm really poorly.
Were you on medication at that point, Denise?
Yeah, I've always been on medication.
You were. Yeah,
okay. And I always will be on that. And I always will be on medication.
Sure.
I've never been on tranquilizers. Again, we have this Victorian image, well, not even Victorian image, of, you know, people in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in white robes shuffling around waiting for Nurse Ratched to come. It's not like that.
No.
I have an antidepressant which replaces the chemicals that are missing in my brain, like you would if you had insulin for a diabetic.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was under a lot of pressure, and I started to knew that I would be going home. I would be dealing with Matty, who I'd moved down to the north. This is self-diagnosis. Mm. And I was incredibly stressed by everything. And I was dealing with underlying depression a lot of the time, whilst meant to be like this, because I was suddenly thrust into the public as this devil woman and everybody loved to hate her. And I was in every magazine and everything. I was really struggling. Mm. And I started to drink. And it was my leap between moderate party drinking and alcoholic drinking was very quick. Mm. And also during Coronation Street, and I tend not to talk about this a lot simply because the word cocaine has a really inflammatory thing on the press. They know that I did it, but I feel comfortable talking to you because I know that you know, you have lived experience of drinking anyway.
Absolutely.
And so bearing in mind, if I was going to do drugs, Janie, I would have done them as a young'un when everybody was doing drugs. You know, it's not like we couldn't get them. You know, it never interested me. It never, not weed, not nothing. You know, I was a barley wine in the park girl, and I was happy with that. It really didn't bother me. It wasn't on my radar. And bearing in mind, I'd been in the business quite a long time by then, so it was around. And I was having a terrible episode. And somebody said to me, you know, this will make you feel better. And I went, oh, I'm not interested in that. And they said, no, but it'll make you feel better. And it did.
And that was cocaine.
Immediately. Yeah, immediately. Immediately for 40 minutes.
Right. Mm. Yeah.
And that was, and the thing is, I never make any excuses for my behavior, but there are reasons for it.
Yes, absolutely.
And so not excuses, but reasons. And that was my downfall. And that was how I felt I was getting through. And then of course, what was happening was that was perpetuating the depression.
Yeah.
So I was on the treadmill for pretty much 15 years.
Yeah.
Because I was so terrified of the come down that I would then be doing that again.
Yeah.
And also, I am a good actress.
Yeah.
So I could pull the wool over people's eyes a lot of the time. Not my mum's. If I'd been on television and I could be sitting on Loose Women in a drama series. I've watched things I've done in dramas before when I've been fucking brilliant. And I can't remember doing those scenes.
Mm.
And I can't remember them because I know where I was the night before.
Yeah.
I would go on Loose Women when I'd had no sleep. And I would be going, and hello, if I was anchoring, you know, hello and welcome to Janie, who is on the show today to talk about her battles with this. Da, 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 da. And my mum would have left a message on my phone in my dressing room saying, you're not well, are you? To see it in my eyes.
Wow.
And I have a lot of guilt. People say to me, you know, what another thing I try to say to people is, why are you feeling guilt about having a mental illness? You have as much chance of getting this as you have of getting cancer. You have no choice over it. But what I do feel guilt about is the way that I dealt with it. And I wish I had sought help sooner, but the right help wasn't out there for me.
No, absolutely.
This wasn't, Janie. And there was a time when I went to Turkey with my family, and I got really, really drunk. Louis was a toddler. Matthew was maybe, I don't know, about 15 or something. And the next day, my depression was so thick, I could feel this starting again. And I screamed and said to my mom, I want to go home and I'm going to stop drinking because stopping drinking is going to stop my depression. And I remember mom and dad stayed with Louis. Tim took me home to England. I phoned Kevin Kennedy, Curly Watts from Coronation Street. They're amazing in the recovery world, Janie. Kevin and Claire, if ever you get the chance to talk to them.
Really? Oh, wow. I'd love to. Thank you for that.
They run an amazing recovery and addiction centre in Brighton, so I'll connect you.
Oh, wow. I'd love to talk to them. Oh, I'd love to.
They're amazing. And so I felt Kevin, and because I had been with him when he was getting sober, because we both had issues at Corrie. Not because of Corrie. Corrie was wonderful. It was just that was the time.
Yeah.
And anyway, so Kevin took me to AA and I felt I'm an alcoholic. I've gone to AA and all will be well. It just wasn't. I stopped drinking for 18 months. But the reason I stopped was because I thought it would cure my depression.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course it didn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
So after 18 months, and also my husband didn't stop drinking, and we know that's difficult.
Yeah, it's very difficult when your partner is not.
Very difficult. And yeah. I'm not saying that he was coming in fairly doomed drunk, as we call it in Newcastle. But you know how when someone's had 3 pints and you're sober, you want to punch them in the face. End of story. And so anyway, I could go on for hours about this. And, you know, sorry, I'm waffling on. But basically, after 18 months, I made the decision, in my words, to step off the wagon. I wasn't going to fall off it. I was stepping off it because I felt that I had my drinking under control.
Yeah.
It wasn't curing my depression, but I knew how to do it. Within 4 weeks, I was a disaster.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
And it took to meeting Lincoln 10 years ago and us both getting sober to pretty much change my life.
Yeah, amazing. There's so much I want to ask you. I'm conscious of time. But what's really interesting, you know, we talked earlier about how when you used to rock up to doctors, people in the medical profession with the postnatal depression, they just didn't get it. They just didn't get the link. It's not their fault. They just didn't get it. They didn't know about it. Well, exactly the same is clearly true even now about the link between alcohol and depression, mental health. So all those years that you were drinking to numb this pain, I'm guessing nobody ever asked you or really challenged you or really had a proper discussion about the link.
Everything about me stopping drinking was my behavior.
Yeah, but they were diagnosing you and continuing to give you medication and everything else that was going on, but not noticing the effects of the alcohol.
I did hide a lot. I did hide a lot. You know, if you've had an alcohol problem, you hide a lot.
You lie to the doctor, of course.
And yeah, of course. And also, I was, you know, again, I don't blame this, but it was a contributing factor. I was hacked by the press. From 2001 to 2007. So I just thought I was incredibly unfortunate that every time I went out and came out of a nightclub going, you know, that the press were there. Well, of course, I was being hacked. But not only that, it made me none of us knew we were being hacked. So it caused a massive distrust within the whole of your friendship circle. So I ended up being friends with people who were just assholes. They were hangers-on. But I didn't trust anybody. You know, so it was like, well, I might as well be hung for a sheep as a fucking lamb, you know. And of course, the people I hurt, the only people, as you know, that hold the mirror up to you, you push out against, which is your family and the people who love you.
Yeah.
And they're the only ones who say, and, you know, like my sister would say, and I'd go, oh, my God, you know, honey, fucking perfect, just because you only have 2 glasses of wine and you nearly pass out. I mean, that was what it was. And it was purely concern for me. But because she knew me so well, she could say it in a more aggressive tone. It makes you push back like that. I haven't got a problem. I'm just having to keep the whole family together. I'm having to do all the work for everybody. That's why I have a dream.
Yeah.
All of that.
Yeah.
And of course, I have massive guilt over Matty. Matty and I are very strong. We have a great relationship. But we have talked about, you know, it's hard having a mom who, you know, who drinks a lot.
Well, you're not present. You're not able to be present for your kids, are you? It's my one massive regret, actually.
Absolutely, same as me. And the thing is, Janie, I don't know. I wasn't an alcoholic who literally woke up in the morning and, you know, moved the cleaning stuff aside to get the vodka like this. I wasn't that kind of alcoholic. So, you know, my kids went to school. They were always fed and dressed and we had some wonderful times. But it was almost like I lived a double life as well, because a lot of my work was in London.
Yeah.
So that was when I just went absolutely crazy. Yeah. And I wish I could redo Matty's childhood. Louis, I mean, having said that, you know, he does say, but Mum, if you hadn't been a bit rock and roll, I wouldn't be in the band. I mean, and I guess that is
exactly, yeah.
Because if he tried to form a band with me and Lincoln, who want to watch True Life Crime and eat a crumpet and be in bed by 10, he would have had nobody. And obviously, Louis was about 9 when we got sober. So he's had a sort of different experience. Yeah, but I'm very close to both my boys. I'm very lucky.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing. So when you finally did then make that decision, you knew it was the right time. Was it that you were able to catch sight of this? You know, I'm always going on about, you know, it's not about whether how much you're drinking or should you give up because you've got to. You really have to ask yourself this question: would my life be better physically, emotionally without it? And had you managed to catch sight at that point of a better life? And how did you go about it that next time then?
Well, I was writing a book called Starting Over, which I came out of the Big Brother house having had a horrendous experience. I should never have gone in. I won it, but it was the hollow victory. Mm. And the press were very unkind to me. And I had management who I thought were protecting me and I thought were kind of trying to make me some money from car crashes, turning it into something that could keep me going and make me money. They were actually causing the car crashes. So unfortunately, I found this out. So I was in this awful situation. And Lincoln and I had met when I was still officially married. I wasn't being adulterous. Tim and I had agreed to separate. We just hadn't decided to tell people yet. So I was yet again, of course, accused of being this terrible adulteress. And that Tim was long-suffering Tim at home cradling our children. It's bollocks. And he knows that it is. But that's the narrative the press had chosen about me. And so I decided to announce the breakup of my marriage on television, on live television, so that I could take the control back from the press, as it were.
Yeah.
Basically say, actually, hang on a minute, this is what's happening. And I was writing this book that had been thrust at me to do called Starting Over. And I hadn't really started over, Janie. I was drinking while I was doing it. And it was just, but I still felt that I was more in control because I was writing this book called Starting Over. It was really ridiculous. But Lincoln and I, and I've said this before, so I'm not spilling any beans, but Lincoln and I, through this madness, as we called it, had managed to, because he also, basically, Lincoln is now an international serving artist. He's brilliant. He's got a thriving career and I couldn't be more proud because of sobriety. When I met him, he was the PR and marketing manager for Stringfellows.
Oh, wow.
He was very successful, but of course living an incredibly nocturnal life. So his partying didn't start till 3 o'clock in the morning when he finished. He'd go round to Soho and his friends would apparently go, "Here's Lincoln, let's get the needle on red." That's what they used to say, like this. So his issues were different. His drinking was out of control, but he would then go for a run and go back in the club and he was functioning and managing to do his job. And we met, the likelihood of it, you know, we met at 6 o'clock in the morning in a nightclub. He was 15 years younger than me. I mean, it doesn't make sense. But we managed to realize that we had something quite special. But when we drank to excess, we rowed and we got nasty with each other. I don't mean physically. And this thing will happen one night, and the next morning I was rehearsing a play called Steel Magnolias. And it was early in the morning before I went to rehearsal. And I remember saying to him, we had this flat in Bermondsey, and I said, "I can't do this anymore. I can't love the person that you were last night." And he pushed back initially, as in, well, you've got a drink problem as well. You know, all of that stuff that goes on. And he was so worried about losing me. Get upset.
Yeah.
He was so worried about losing me. He gave up drinking that day, that minute. And I decided that I didn't have as much of a problem because, of course, I was doing a play with these wonderful actresses like Shelley Lungi and Isla Blair and Cheryl Campbell, Casey Ainsworth. We were on tour in this really prestigious show. And I didn't really have that much of a problem because I could do the show and then have one glass of wine and go home. So it's quite interesting talking about it like this, actually. So there was one night that we were at Brighton Theatre Royal, and Lincoln at this time had given up string cellos, and he was kind of doing some marketing, but he was able to come around with me a bit and drive me to these different places, and I loved having him with me. And he said to me this one morning in Brighton at this hotel, Grand Hotel, he said, God, you were really mean to me last night. And I went, I wasn't, I only had two glasses of wine. He said, well, you had two glasses when you came off stage, then you had two glasses in the pub, mm-hmm. then we came back to the hotel and you had two glasses here, so you had a bottle and a half of wine. Oh, you're counting me in drinks now, all of this. Anyway, culminated in, we did Richmond Theatre. We all decided to get some celebrity friends around, create a bit of a buzz, because it was the nearest we were going to be to London, and get a bit of publicity for the rest of the tour. So I remember Isla Blair invited Derek Jacobi, and I had Nanny Pat from the Essex Club. And it was this amazing cross-section of people. Anyway, I'd said to Lincoln, I've got two shows tomorrow, and I know the press are coming. So if I start to get drunk, will you just give me a little nudge? Lincoln goes, darling, I know the guy that you've just flirted with is gay, but the Paps are taking pictures through the window and they don't know that. So I'm just saying, you might want to tone it down. And the next morning, I was plastered over a newspaper in a red dress, pointing at Lincoln like this. And we'd got back to his flat in Kensington, and he had videoed me, and he basically said, I didn't look at the video. He basically said, I love you more than life itself, but I can't do this sober. And he came to pick me up at the theatre that night, and he drove me from Richmond to Kensington and told me how much he loved me and how he didn't want to make me stop if I didn't want to. And I thought, I cannot let this person not know who's coming in the door at night. Mm. And we got back to the flat, sat in the car for 2 hours outside, and I've never had a drink from that night.
Wow. Amazing.
And it saved my life, Janie, you know?
Totally. Yeah. Wow. It's just been so fantastic to talk to you. I know that, you know, the book is just you're going to have so much success with this. It's such important work that you're doing.
Thank you so much, Janie.
And thank you for being so candid. And it's just amazing to hear your story, just helping so many people. So I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll hook you up with Kevin and Claire.
I would love that. Thank you so much. Brilliant. Appreciate
it. Lots of love. Thanks,
Janie. Bye.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it. defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So just a reminder, if you want to get connected, come on down, come to our 7th birthday celebration at Hello Love in Bloomsbury, 10th of September. The link will be in the show notes, or you can go to thesoberclub.com/events. While you're there on the events page, you'll also see details of our next Turn Your Sobriety to Purpose webinar, which is going to be on the 17th of September. I think I'm right in saying. So you can register for that. If you've quit the booze and you're thinking about a new purpose, make sure you come along to that. And of course, if you are, you know, back at the other end of the spectrum, if you're early days, or if you're just wanting support on your journey, wanting encouragement, wanting well-being content, then just come and join us in the Sober Club. It's low cost. It's really high value. There's masses of exclusive content, including William Porter in there, of course, doing some exclusive videos for us. And we have a private group where we just share all kinds of stuff, and we become cheerleaders for each other. It's very small, very supportive. So check out thesoberclub.com, and I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show on UK Health Radio.